Yeah, you are listening to Tech Talk here on News Talk. This is Jess Kelly. Before the break, we were talking about Instagram's teen accounts, which are coming to Ireland later this year. They've started to roll out in different parts of the world. But if you want to initiate some of the online safety conversations with your children right now, so ahead of the arrival of the teen accounts in Ireland, there are some brilliant resources out there for parents. One that I want to mention in particular is on the ispcc.ie website. So the ISPCC does incredible work and has done for many years now. But one area in which they are, I suppose, going the extra mile for both parents and children is around digital education. So if you go to ispcc.ie, at the top of the website, you'll see a portion or a tab called Digital Hub. And this is a space for both children and parents. So you can go in and you can read different news updates. You can tap into videos where you have a series of online experts explaining different aspects of the online world. They give you prompts for conversations with your children. There are different guides and tips when it comes to building digital resilience, empathy online, what are the big risks when it comes to the digital world, but also what to do if something goes wrong. I do think, you know, as I said in the chat with Tara Hopkins there a minute ago, there are great benefits from what they're doing now. It's a huge stride in terms of introducing these online teen accounts, but teenagers aren't just on Instagram. They're on other platforms, and I think it's important for parents to know where they can turn if and when something does arise. So again, it's the ispcc.ie website. Just search for it, click on Digital Hub, and there is plenty of stuff there that is worth your time. And as I said, it's worth getting ahead of before an issue arises. Right, something that caught my eye, talking of Instagram, this week was a conversation around the company culture at Netflix. They have something called the Keeper Test, which we're going to talk about in just a quick minute. But it got me thinking about, and I suppose chatting to some people about, how tech companies set the bar for company culture. So there was a time a few years ago where I'd walk into a tech office and they'd have a ping pong table and a beer keg and all the rest. That seems to have gone away. Attitudes from the company's point of view and the worker's point of view have shifted. So what actually matters when it comes to company culture, and should that dictate where you work? I'm joined now by Paul McArdle of The Panel and a contributor to The Currency. Paul, I've read some of the pieces you've written recently about different books about company culture. Obviously, there's the one that we're going to come to in a quick minute about Netflix in particular. But before we get into that, I just wonder, have lessons been learned about worker well-being and company culture post-pandemic? Because a lot of the tech companies, you know, when the pandemic hit, they were saying this is the new normal. Remote working is the new normal. We won't force employees back to the office. We'll let them do that whole thing of work anywhere. But now it's a case of, not only do we want you back, but you have to come back.
So, first of all, thanks for having me on, Jess. Secondly, the big tech companies originally, when COVID drove this, they got access to much greater talent pools who are working remotely. So they were finding talent all around the globe who they didn't have to be in office. There was a bit of a gold rush of COVID, and then we've seen with some of the tech companies that that COVID gold rush is gone, and then they've resized their businesses. How some of them handle that is a lesson in not how to do it, because they're doing it by small cuts rather than doing one big cut at the time. And culturally, that had a very adverse effect on the people who are going, who felt their loyalty wasn't rewarded, and on the people who are staying because they didn't know where they're going to be next or not. The push into the office in a lot of the tech companies tends to be US-led. I think partially because a lot of those businesses have investments in office themselves. So they are looking to drive people into buildings that they are paying for. They believe that culturally people work better together on site than they do remotely. But when it suited them, when people work remotely, they thought the culture was fine. So on the situations as I see it, that we're kind of at a tipping point. The power is going back towards the employer. We did a candidate sentiment survey with 2,000 people, which the panel, which we published in the Currency. And for the first time, they feel the power is back with the employer. But it's very well balanced. And what's going to be interesting, Jess, is to see how this plays out in the next 6, 12, 18 months.
How and where does this sit within the culture of big tech companies as they exist right now? Like I mentioned the piece that you wrote recently for The Currency about Netflix as an example. When we look at how they operate, are there lessons to be learned for the tech sector as a whole from what they do and their approach?
So Netflix have no rules. They're very specific culture where they have what's called F&R, freedom and responsibility. So they have a culture of empowerment for their teams. So what that means is that a person, if they think it's right for Netflix, can go and, for example, buy a very large TV program, commit to that without going through a hierarchical structure and waiting for everybody to say yes to it. The other thing about it is they believe in talent density. In a nutshell, what happened was they let people go who were underperforming, and they found that productivity went up with less people. So they have a thing called the Keeper Test. So the Keeper Test has developed within Netflix. It started with the question is, if one of your team hands in their notice, how hard would you work to keep them? And that became known as the Keeper Test. And then they had a second iteration of that, Jess, and where instead of waiting for someone to hand in their notice when they're reviewing their team, they'd actually, the question was, if that person did hand in their notice, how hard would I fight to keep them? And keep talent density up. If the answer to that was, I wouldn't fight to keep them, they would sit down with that person and cut a check and let them go. So they have gone from a lot of companies would have culture just around being family. Netflix would be have a culture very similar to that of a professional sports team. And so you need to be a high level performer, you need to be consistent. And if you're not consistent or your performance dips, then there are other places that you should work rather than Netflix.
That notion of we're all one family here, like that used to be the norm in work. It was seen as a very enticing prospect for employees. But another lesson that was learned during the pandemic was around employee expectations, their needs, their wants, and so on. We know that they want to do meaningful work and be fulfilled. Is it too much to say that perhaps the approach by Netflix and their Keeper Test could be actually mutually beneficial? Because if you're not performing well, maybe it's because you're not fully bought in?
Definitely is for high performers. It definitely is. And you're spot on. I think that people are very keen to have a material positive effect in their workplace by the nature of the work that they do. So they want to be working on projects that are meaningful. They want to be more productive, and they want to be involved in decision making. That's one thing that the Netflix team have done with the freedom to go make decisions you think are right for Netflix, but the responsibility to come with that, the F&R, that yin and yang, that balance to get it right. On the family piece, there are still companies who do that, and I think it's still as valid today. There was, in fact, in the panel, we have our values are plan, so which is the Irish word for family. So we would see ourselves culturally aligned with that. Where Netflix, they were saying if it's a professional sports team, having a family culture is not relevant to that because you're not going to put your brother or sister, in inverted commas, out of the team. So I think different cultures work well within different businesses. Netflix has proven to work well for them, but it's been well honed by Netflix over a number of years.
The other thing that we know is that culture and cultural differences is something that really impacts tech companies. Anytime I'm out at the likes of Microsoft or Meta or whatever big tech company, you see diverse teams, which is obviously great. But I wonder if that, you know, we're a sports team versus we're a family approach is actually a better one when it comes to, I suppose, leveling the playing field for office and company culture at large.
I would say that, so Erin Marr is the professor in INSEAD, so she co-wrote the Netflix book on their culture, and she also wrote the culture map. On the culture map, I think one of the most important books I've read this year, it deals with how you deal with people from different cultures and how they deal with you. I think that is more related to our cultural background as opposed to whether we're in a Netflix or in a family-led culture. So, for example, he gives in the book that if you say something to an Irish person, we take things literally and we know what is meant. If you say something to a Japanese colleague, for example, they look for nuances and they might interpret it in a very different way, so they don't take it literally. So whether you're working in a Netflix or whether you're working in a family culture environment, that is really important to know. So I think that it's more to do, as I said, with our own different cultural nuances rather than the type of company culture that we work in is the most important thing to pay attention to.
What does all this mean for the future of work? Like, we've been talking about work anywhere culture for quite a while. It, you know, was seen to be a great way to let people live the lives they want to live whilst also working hard when they were in, you know, work mode. Are we shifting back to office-based workplaces with the Netflix-like keeper test for each business to find and flesh out their own ethos?
Oh, I think that Netflix culture is something that they've built over a long time and is going to suit some businesses and not suit a lot of others. There is still a talent shortage on the market. What I spoke earlier about would be more an employer market than an employee market, yes. That is going to be a factor in getting more people back into the office. However, I do not think it's going to be straightforward. The other thing I would say is I think that remote work and hybrid working is here to stay, and it worked very, very well in a lot of situations, and it doesn't in others. I don't see a huge change in that because I think it's going to be driven to where the talent actually is. And so, for example, if you're a business and you need a software developer and that person happens to be in Eastern Europe and can do the job very sufficiently there rather than have them come in here, where there's a housing crisis and shortage, and you have to pay them probably more to be in situ in the office, then that solution, like Darren's solution, is always going to win out, in my opinion. So I do think things are going to change. I think you're going to see more people coming into the office, but maybe not to the level that which is mainly US-led companies would like to do.
If you're a small or medium business here in Ireland and you're looking at, you know, how to get the most out of your team, is the conversation that we've had up to now, is this something that only applies to multinationals, or are there takeaways here for the SMBs?
So, yes, the great thing about smaller companies is they're much more flexible. So we talked about purpose. Smaller businesses are nimble. You get a lot of wider experience in them than you would in a large multinational where people tend to be in more siloed roles. You've got more flexibility in working arrangements. A lot of SMEs I know, because there's a smaller number of people, they don't have to be as rigid in their processes and in their controls. With the Netflix example or with the family example, a lot of the SMEs pick what the best culture is for them and develop their own culture in time. So there's no reason why they can't have people performing at a very high level, but have, say, a more family-friendly approach to how those people work. And that's where I think that SMEs have quite a competitive advantage at the moment, because they've much more control in setting their own culture due to the scale of the business. They can influence that culture much better than, say, a large company can.
I've been thinking about this for quite a while, and when I read your piece in The Currency about Netflix, it really got me thinking about younger generations entering the workforce. From, you know, research that I've done, from what I've read, what I've seen, what I've heard, be that in my life or on social media, the younger generation definitely has a different attitude to work. There was talk, you know, on TikTok not that long ago about Gen Z quiet quitting and not doing anything beyond their job description. And as a millennial, that jumped out at me because that's just not the way I started my career, and it's not how I work to this day. How do the different generations in a workplace that is shifting or that has a more hardline approach excel and get ahead?
So yes, it's interesting. We've had taken on people who are in their early 20s, and we find them just like you were, very willing to learn. I haven't seen that thing work, kind of work the rule, that TikTok generation piece that you're talking about. The big issue culturally for younger people is they're not learning things by osmosis. If they're working remotely or if they're working in a mainly hybrid fashion, the huge plus of working in an office and working beside people more senior from you, you learn far more from listening to them or seeing how they operate. And that has been missing. Quite interestingly, Jess, the issue with going into the office, not the younger people, it's the partners, MDs, in a number of the professional services firms, both in law firms and in accountancy firms, they've had to have a policy to get the partners in as opposed to the young people in. I find any of the young people that I've met, and I myself learned from the ground up, and I think you did as well when you went into New Talk. I think you were a runner off memory and learned your way around. I found young people coming into our business, and we've had a number of interns and a number of people who've taken on permanently. I've had a superb attitude to learn that. I don't recognize that TikTok generation at all. What I do simply for people of the younger generation is they're not getting the opportunity to learn by osmosis the way that you and I did back in the day.
Yeah, and that is something that really resonates with me. Like when I started making tea and coffee here in Newstalk, I was watching and learning how to behave, but also how not to behave by osmosis. How important is it for potential employees to do their homework on a company's culture before they go for a job and find out if they are, you know, a keep or test kind of company or a family-like business? Because that really does set the tone for the entire work life.
It absolutely does. But I think the most people nowadays are very savvy. A lot of them are on social media, and it's very easy to find out about companies either from whatever they have communicated externally, from their employer branding, or from hearing from people working in that place and from friends and colleagues who might have worked there in the past. What I would say for somebody looking for work is that a lot of employers are taking the aptitude for granted. It's the attitude of the person that is key, and that's proved to be a key differentiator. The second thing I would say, Jess, is in the past, and I've recruited myself, they always had prerequisite that somebody had to have a degree. That's gone now. Thankfully, we're going towards a more skilled-based hiring. So they are looking at skills that the individual paths and seeing how they can apply to the particular role. In the past, you would have, say, I'm looking for a degree, and it was just to filter out people rather than put them in. So I think that as candidates got more difficult to get, one of the good things that's happened is that employers are more open to the background of people that they take on. Another branch of people that have done well out of this, well, two really, people with disabilities. So remote working has opened up roles for them that wouldn't have had in the past. And I think there's a rise in the grey market. People 50, I think employers are seeing that there is value in taking those people on where ageism was fairly rife beforehand. So I think there's positive things out there in the job market. Employers are looking at wider talent pools and more opportunities for people who may have been restricted in the past.
Okay, there is no doubt that we are in an interesting time, and I imagine this is something that we will come back to time and again. But for now, Paul McArdle, thanks so much for joining me here on News Talk.
Yes, thank you so much. Have a great day.
I would love to know what you make of the keeper test. Is that fair enough? Maybe you work on a team that you think could benefit from it. Let me know. You can email me techtalk@newstalk.com. Right, when we come back, I'll answer your tech questions.